From Macedonia to Northern Ireland to the Middle East and dozens of other places around the world, violence runs parallel with efforts to end it. At times, protracted negotiations open the way for an uneasy calm and eventually to a semblance of peace, and such places as Vietnam fade from the front pages. Too often, however, the optimism raised by summit meetings at Camp David or in Geneva or Oslo is blown apart by a suicide bomber or a helicopter rocket attack. Bill Ury is director of the Project on Preventing War at the Harvard Law School Program on Negotiation. From the Coop Studios in Boulder, Colorado, he told us that although the places and personnel change, there is a universal truth at every peace negotiation.
The common thread is that all around the world, actually, right now, there's a painful education going on for people who are learning, basically, that you can't win these wars. And what happens is people, you know, lose enough. You know, it's like Mahatma Gandhi once said, an eye for an eye and we all go blind. We all get enough blind that at some point people say there's got to be a better way, and they start returning to the table and they start negotiating. And that's what happened in South Africa when both sides realized that there was no way they could win. The whites realized that maybe they could hold on for another 10 or 20 years, but in the long run, they couldn't. The African National Congress realized that, you know, they could maybe win in 20 years, but what kind of South Africa would they inherit? And then both sides come to the table. So there's a hurting stalemate.
As a negotiator, is there a difference in your approach depending on the circumstances that led to these wars that can't be won? In other words, is an indigenous rebellion different from an occupation?
There are a lot of differences. Every situation is different. But it's not that different a process than what goes on across the family dinner table. I mean, you know, one of the big myths about conflict is that it can be ended. You know, we think we can, you know, shake hands or go to Camp David and we can end the conflict. But somehow we know at a simpler level, you know, if you've got a bad marriage and you go off for a weekend retreat, no one's going to expect you to waive a contract saying we've solved all our problems. It's going to be a question of how do we continue to deal with our conflict in a constructive way. And in the Middle East right now, for example, the hope was raised that they were going to be able to end the conflict. And that was an unrealistic hope. I mean, the best you can do really is say, look, we're going to continue in this conflict. And the question is not to end it or not, but the question is, do we handle it destructively through violence, through terrorism, through occupation? Or do we handle it constructively through democracy and negotiation and coexistence? And that's a hard process. That's a process that has to take place not just at the table, but between peoples who are living in each other's neighborhoods.
What does a good mediator then do when you're at the table and violence has been spiraling out of control and both sides are in this conflict and you want to handle it constructively, but each side is calling for reprisals?
Yeah, I think what you then have to do is you have to look at the whole question of distrust, which is deep in these situations, and you have to take that front on and say to both parties, you go off in the corner here, you Israelis, and come up with 10 steps that are concrete, practical, operational, that the Palestinians, that Chairman Arafat or whoever, could conceivably take that would send a signal to you that they were, you know, they could be trusted, you were ready to start negotiating again. And you ask the Palestinians to do the same thing. Then you exchange those lists. And maybe they can't do 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, but they say, hey, I could do 1 or 5. And then they start, you know, they take one step, the other side de-escalates, and then you painfully kind of build back a modicum of trust so that you can begin addressing the issues again.
Of course, you have to get them to the table before you can get their minds off killing one another, right?
Yeah, and the truth is, in the media, it seems like they're all at each other's throats, but I'm almost positive there are quiet contacts going on. And the thing that I'm always impressed by in these conflicts is, in any negotiation, you have to keep your eye not just on the table where, say, the Israelis and the Palestinians are talking to each other or not talking to each other, but on the other two tables, which are the internal tables of each side, where the Israelis are talking amongst themselves and the Palestinians. And that was, I think, maybe the single biggest mistake so far in the Middle East negotiations, is there was so much focus on the Israelis and Palestinians getting to a deal, for example, at Camp David, that people forgot about, hey, what about the people? I mean, are you really bringing your people along? Are they really ready to make the kinds of concessions that you're talking about at the table? And if you don't bring your people along, then you find that the situation can blow up in your face. And so you really need to manage all three tables. And the mediator needs to be particularly concerned about that.
How does international political pressure and domestic political pressure then play into that when you are actually in negotiations with folks who are not at each other's throats, as you say? What causes one? Does one win over the other sometimes?
These things only work out. They're only stable in the long run if both sides can walk away in some sense winning. And one of the most useful exercises I find in any of these situations is to take out a sheet of paper and write down the victory speech of each side. In other words, what would Arafat need to be able to say to his people that would allow him to engage in negotiations again or to come to an agreement? What would Sharon need to say to his people? Write out those victory speeches. If you can't write out a victory speech for each side, then you know you've got work to do.
Are these exciting? Are negotiations exciting? Are there highs that you can anticipate, lows that you can anticipate?
I find them very exciting. I mean, I know they don't sound very exciting. Sometimes it seems like just people are kind of an easy chair or making statements. But in the room itself or in the process itself, I must say that, you know, peace, making peace is a lot harder than making war. I mean, it's a lot easier to shoot your enemy than it is to actually have to listen to them. And so what you see is people go through changes when you get them into this kind of process. It's a very complex thing, and we're just beginning to really learn how to do this. I mean, we're still in our infancy, and we've had a lot more experience, I think, making war than we have at making peace.
Bill Ury is the author of Getting Past No, Negotiating Your Way from Confrontation to Cooperation, and he joined us from Coop Studios in Colorado. Thanks a lot.
Leanne, it's a pleasure.